This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
One of the world's most popular information websites has declared the Anti-Defamation League as an unreliable source. The editors at Wikipedia now say that the top Jewish civil rights group and one of the world's preeminent authorities on anti-Jewish hate is not a reliable source for information about the Israel-Palestine conflict and anti-Semitism. The editors cited the ADL's roles as both an advocacy and research organization, claiming that prevents the group from providing unbiased accounts on these topics. The move, of course, comes amid a surge in anti-Semitic incidents on college campuses across the country since the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel, with more than 1,800 incidents reported in just the past 8 months. That's up 700% compared to last year.
Welcome to the Law Bites podcast. This podcast drops on Monday, October 7th. The one-year anniversary of the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. I've largely kept the issue of the rising tide of anti-Semitism since the Hamas attacks off this podcast, but those that follow my work will know that I've been vocal on both social media and the mainstream media, expressing my shock and concern. This episode blends my professional focus on digital policy with my personal concerns regarding anti-Semitism. Now, it's worth noting that for me, October 7th actually began on October 6th. I was dozing after a family Sabbath dinner meal when I was suddenly awoken by the continuous buzzing of the Tzofar Red Alert app on my phone and watch. I had installed the app, which is widely used in Israel to warn of imminent rocket fire, months earlier while visiting on a teaching assignment, and I'd forgotten that it was still on my phone. At first, I thought the app was malfunctioning, since the buzzing simply wouldn't stop, and it implausibly appeared that hundreds of communities were under attack. Hours later, I of course learned there was nothing wrong with the app, and that I digitally witnessed the start of the October 7th massacre in real time. I've since deleted the app, but a year later, it feels as if the Canadian Jewish community needs something similar to warn of anti-Semitic outbreaks. Such an app would buzz nearly daily, given the rise of anti-Semitism, which emanates with astonishing frequency from both the extreme right and left. Indeed, what would have once sparked immediate condemnation now occurs with little commentary or surprise. Synagogue vandalism incidents too numerous to mention. Jewish schools and community centers hit with gunfire or makeshift bombs. Jewish senior homes and hospitals facing hostile protests. And university campuses home to what multiple presidents admit is a significant anti-Semitism problem. Those are offline incidents, but the online world raises its own concerns. I witness it personally whenever I post on anti-Semitism, but it rears its head in other ways. For example, it has become apparent that Wikipedia, one of the most popular and important sites on the internet, has an anti-Semitism problem. It has cropped up on entries involving issues like Zionism, and even in the targeting of groups like the ADL, as you heard off the top. Now, this won't come as a surprise to Professor Jan Grabowski, professor of Holocaust studies at the University of Ottawa, who conducted a detailed study on the issue in 2023, which focused on the Holocaust page involving Poland, his area of expertise. Professor Grabowski joins me on the podcast to talk about his work, his Wikipedia study, and the threat of disinformation on the site. Jan, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining. You know, this podcast is going to be released in its regular Monday slot, which for the first week of October happens to be October the 7th. So it's been 12 months since the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, and there's been a rise in anti-Semitism in places like Canada that I have to admit I never thought was possible. I haven't much discussed it on this podcast, but I've been vocal about it on social media, my blog, Substack, and op-eds. And I have to say that regardless of whatever platform I'm on, the hate that often follows is pretty stunning. Of course, it isn't limited to my blog. We've seen a rise in anti-Semitism, not just offline, but online as well. It's seemingly sometimes everywhere. And that includes Wikipedia, where there's been an unmistakable rise in disinformation related to Jews, Judaism, Israel, Zionism. Now, this may not come as a surprise to you, as you were covering this issue well before October 7th and published a peer-reviewed study that touches on many of these issues. So I'd like to learn more about what you found. But first, you know, can you introduce yourself, your work, and provide a bit of a background on some of the very real threats that you faced in recent years as part of your work?
Thank you, Michael, for this introduction. Well, my in terms of brief autobiography here, my name is Jan Grabowski. I'm professor of history of the Holocaust at University of Ottawa and have been working here for last more than 30 years. And for last 25 years or so, I have been documenting and writing about the history of the fate of Polish Jewry during the Holocaust, and which is one of the saddest parts of human history, given the fact that Polish Jewry was 3.3 million strong and practically has been annihilated in the time. And so I have been writing basically what happened at this, at the crossroads or at the edge between when the fate of the Jews met with the fate of, or decisions of non-Jews, in this case of Poles in Poland. And so I looked less at perpetrators from the German side, who have been well known and described. I tried to ascertain or to find out what happened between the Jews and the Poles, who were surrounding, let's say, the Jews at the time. And my findings were not, let's say, met with much delight by Polish authorities, and I would say major part of Polish public opinion, and the issues of complicity, the issues of collaboration, which I basically exposed or wrote about, provoked, triggered very strong and very hostile emotions, especially so after 2015, when Polish nationalists gained power and until last year governed pushing the country from democracy toward a hardline authoritarian rule, destroying in process the system of justice, and also attacking historians who basically countered or undermined the whole mythology on which their ethos, patriotic ethos, has been created or built or founded. So here, you know, one thing, it's when you have to deal with critics of your historical work, writing reviews, hostile even reviews in learned papers or even in mainstream media, it's something quite different when you have to confront the hostile fury of a state with limitless resources. So I was in this unfortunate position to have been selected as one of the very few, let's say, enemies of the people. And I was dragged through courts, I was threatened, and Ottawa police had to open a couple of dossiers on me. It was, for someone who was an archival historian, quite a difficult situation, and to an extent still continues despite the change of tone in official circles and the government. The issues of this national dignity and pride, national pride, are still very much on the agenda. So just to finish the long story, it was a rather harrowing last 8 years, and also financially very disruptive, given the fact that I was sued in civil litigation. So this is the kind of world that Holocaust scholars have to contemplate before they venture into this kind of intellectual endeavor.
Yeah, no, it's such a deeply troubling story, but also such important work. Now, speaking of that work, in 2023, you published an article, Wikipedia's Intentional Distortion of the History of the Holocaust, together with Shira Klein, who's a professor at Chapman University in California. That work appeared in the Journal of Holocaust Research. I want to get into, of course, that study. But first, you know, what prompted you to focus on that specific issue?
It's actually a funny question. 6-7 years ago, I started to get very bizarre questions from my students in my Holocaust classes. Questions actually which had nothing to do with what I taught in class, nothing to do with what they had in their readings. And it was basically a question of Jewish complicity, of Jewish bringing their own misfortune upon themselves. When I started to inquire, I found out that the source of this nonsense was English Wikipedia, the most widely read website, one of the most heavily read websites in the world, and especially in this domain. So I rarely used Wikipedia, but now I started to look more at this the story, and I found, so lo and behold, that there is my own bio, which I had no idea that there was one on Wikipedia, which was written as if I were basically, a not a mass murderer, but close to it, someone who wants to murder the reputation of Polish people. It was written as if Polish ultra-nationalists were driving the writing, which they were, as I found out, and that's what it, when I wrote an article or two back in 2020 in Polish, but then I hit the wall because I got some replies, not so much, and I didn't have the know-how of simply how Wikipedia, on technical side, how Wikipedia worked. So I knew what were the lies, I knew what was falsified, I had no clue how these things were being done because I didn't know much about the internal workings of the Wikipedia. And here, Professor Shira Klein, who was actually a specialist in digital media, she came to me. She had read something, and she was also confronted by her students about the same area, which she didn't even teach. And so she selected, she chose, she knocked on my, virtually speaking, knocked on my door. And that's when we started to work together, which, resulted in this article, which I am delighted to say, I think has been accessed more than 50 or 60,000 times, which, beats anything you can do when you publish in, a specialized academic review. Normally, so that's the origin. These distortions of the Holocaust on on English Wikipedia were worse, I found, than on Polish Wikipedia in the area which I was, studying.
Super interesting background and shows the impact that, of course, Wikipedia can have. Your paper notes that the study was really the first of its kind in both scope and method. So, can you describe a bit what you did?
Right. Well, so on the surface, you have something called in the main space pages, and that's what you and I and most of 99% of other readers access to Wikipedia. So these main space pages are what you see on the screen of computer without any further clicking. And so we looked at 25 of large articles. Sometimes they go, on tens of pages, and articles which dealt with Polish-Jewish relations and which were heavily, I would say, tainted. And then we went behind the scenes. That's mostly, actually, this expedition was mostly organized by Professor Klein. So she went to so-called, talk, it's called talk pages, where actually the editors who make the writing, who make the changes, they discuss the issues. There are, special notice boards that you can't see normally, but you can access them too. You just have to know where to click. And that's where editors who are in trouble, they ask questions. It's behind, let's say, their cuisine, their kitchen. That's where things get done. And then you look at the diffs. Diffs is our way simply which show you what were the changes between previous version and next version and next version. When Shira, for instance, accessed my bio, she found out that my bio was 1 month changed 360 times. So the more this effervescence or battle you can see, there is the more interesting it gets. So we looked at hundreds of these back pages and arbitration cases where stuff be, where editors cannot come to agreement. There are special Wikipedia courts, let's say, which we can discuss further on in a moment. So basically, we went as far as interview some of the editors, although it's very difficult because Wikipedia is a very, I would say, not clandestine organization. It's very open, but people keep aliases. They are incognito, so they are not Jan Grabowski, but they go X365, right? And it's very, very, actually, very rarely they want to shed this anonymity. In some cases, we're able to find out who is who, but and we could interview a couple of them. But it's very rare because normally they prefer very much to remain in obscurity.
I wanted to ask why it matters, and in some ways, what brought you to the article highlights why it matters. If you're being presented with misinformation from your own students, and that's a common thing, that's obviously an issue. But just how big or important is Wikipedia, specifically with respect to the issue of Holocaust history in Poland? You know, how big is
Right.
are the kind of articles that you're talking about in
I mean,
terms of
look,
their
we are
impact?
talking. If you are talking about these articles that we looked at closely, some of them are accessed more than 100,000 times per month. I mean, we are talking about absolutely massive readership. So if you add up over the years, we are talking millions of few years, not many even years, a few years, we are talking about millions of clicks or attempts to get information. They can come from same person, but I mean, in any case, it translates into hundreds of thousands and millions of openings of these websites, of these articles. So it's incomparably more influential than anything you and I can, try to do. So it's actually for many of us, Wikipedia is not only, as it normally is, a point of departure. It's also a point of arrival. So we start and we finish our quest for information with Wikipedia. So given these hundreds of thousands, millions of sites, we are talking about a massive collateral and direct massive damage.
Okay, so why don't we talk a bit about that, those kinds of harms that you identify? Your article identifies some pretty extensive examples of active distortions that have taken
Right.
place. Can you provide a few examples?
Before I go there, just one more thing, and I was amazed when I found out, and she was amazed too, that there are three areas on Wikipedia, on entire Wikipedia, there are three areas where Wikipedia internal, let's say, administrators decided to raise the barrier of difficulty, so not anyone can add anything. Normally, Jan Grabowski can see it as computer register and go online and start changing, entries, with more or less success. Now there are three areas in which you have to have 500 previous successful interventions. So you have to be basically already an advanced editor before you can start making changes to these areas. One of them is, no doubt you can guess, Israel-Palestine conflict. The second one is Pakistani-India conflict. And the third is history of Polish-Jewish relations during Second World War. Go figure, right? I mean, how crazy it can get. And so what happens here is basically a massive, I would say, a massive invasion of Polish nationalism, which is ferocious as far as Jewish history and the Holocaust is concerned. And so, for instance, it is a backlash against the Jews, basically. What you have is English Wikipedia will now, in the context of Polish Jewish history during World War II, will multiply and will advance the anti-Jewish, deeply anti-Semitic stereotypes. Jewish complicity in own, for instance, to give an example, Jewish complicity in own demise, in own tragedy. Why? Well, you stress the importance of Jewish councils. You stress the importance of Jewish police. You look at the so-called Jewish complicity with the Bolsheviks. So the myth of Judeo-commune, which has been so hurtful. So basically, these and on the other side, you have collaboration with the Axis powers. You will have attempts to present once again the Jews as complicit. And then on the other side, you have this huge distortion and falsification of history, basically exploding the role of the Polish society in saving the Jews during the war. I mean, one thing that people forget is that out of 3 million Polish Jews who at some point found themselves under the Nazi occupation, 30,000 lived out of 3 million. You have 99% death rate. Okay, it's one of the most horrifying efficiencies among the genocides that we know. 99%. And in the context of this, you have Wikipedia articles claiming that you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Poles involved in saving the Jews. So extraordinary, I would say, distortion on this kind. So Polish righteous among the nations being unique people, extraordinary people, but really exceptions being presented as basically, default position of the entire society. So it goes on and on, but this is about the gist of it. When you have these art, then you have, of course, Polish underground, articles on Polish underground allegedly being deeply involved in saving the Jews and punishing Poles, very, very few Poles, who who would do something against these Jews. And then it spills on the afterwar period about the pogrom in Kielce and other stuff. So wherever basically you touch things which undermine a Polish mythology of so-called Polish innocence during the war, then you hit this distortion. And I could go on with examples, but this basically reflects, you know, wherever you touch, you will find the same pattern.
You made reference already to some of the editors and administrators, but, you know, Wikipedia is well known for the role that those administrators, editors, and the community more broadly plays in trying to safeguard against misinformation. So what did you find as you dug into this about the process, and why did it fail?
Okay. Well, yeah, you know, the thing is that once, first of all, we are discussing already an area which is allegedly under, you know, scrutiny by Wikipedia. So one would hope that here the changes would be, you know, vetted. It was not so. What we found out, I was actually amazed. What Shira emerged from these top pages with was evidence that you have a small group of people. You have, of course, they have pseudonyms, so we don't know who they are. But in a few cases, we found out they were Polish expatriates working in, let's say, marginal institutions, learning institutions in the States or somewhere else. Mobilized, you cannot say, but you can assume that by their nationalistic zeal in order to defend the good name of the nation. But the problem is they were very few. We found here the evidence that 7 to 8 people actually working in collusion, which is not very, which is actually forbidden by Wikipedia rules, but easily bypassed, that 7 or 8 people working together were able to dominate the field and eliminate all editors who came to correct it, because Wikipedia in principle is this self-cleansing organization. If you write that Earth is flat, then people will come and they will very quickly correct it. However, if what we found out that these 7 or 8 people who produced 40 to 70% of content of these articles which we were looking at, what they did is they use certain tricks. For instance, Wikipedia is based on references. So in other words, if I say that Professor Geist is really a very poor scholar, then I better have a reference that can back me up. Or if I say that Grabowski is worth nothing, then also I have to do the same thing. Now, the thing is that what they did is they took absolutely marginal sources or unreliable or marginal authors, and then elevated them to the working together. They basically ensured their nobility and they gave them the panache. They gave them the respectability, which they never deserved. A marginal, I mean, authors where they attempted sometimes with success to raise to this point of referencing author, straight anti-Semites, so well known. The thing is, they used Polish sources. So most of the editors would not know Polish, right? If they knew, probably they wouldn't be eager to engage. Perhaps they were going in the same direction. And so, using the relative obscurity of the sources they worked with, they elevated these marginal authors. And at the same time, they brought down authors. I mean, we found on these back top pages, we found evidence of, for instance, there is one of the most greatest American historians of the Holocaust, Christopher Browning, is being described by these editors as simply nobody, as know nothing. So this is the way in which they work. And second, they attack as a pack. They attack editors with a brutal way. I mean, some of these words you could read on back pages are absolutely frightening. I won't even repeat them, of course, on air. But it was, if I were an innocent editor who wants simply, you know, to devote some of my time without any pay to make a change, and suddenly you are being not pressured, but you are being threatened. So this is the way they scared away the, let's say, normal editors, and they elevated these marginal sources to the position of quotable ones. And the problem is that once they legitimized these marginal sources, the field was theirs. Because if one of these sources, one of these citations withstood attempts by other editors to overturn it, it was legit. And then you could basically repeat it ad nauseam all over the place. That's what it did, actually. They would take one page from a marginal American historian and defend it in one place and then spill the same reference all over the other article. So, I mean, there were so many other things, but one thing which was frightening really was that it took so little to make changes in the way hundreds of thousands of or millions of people would perceive things like, let's say, history of the Polish Jews, right? Or article, history of Auschwitz concentration camp. So, you know, these are the things which very many people access. So that's more or less what we found.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's remarkable to, as you say, to see how a small number of people can have that kind of outsized influence. You also, I think, found, though, that there was some amount of extension into the political realm as part of this. Can you
Right.
describe
I mean,
what that was about?
the thing is that it's very, you know, we had to be very, very cautious. And I have learned my lesson that each and every word I write, which will be public, and each and every word I utter, including here our meeting, I know that there is a very high possibility that they will be scrutinized, and I will be dragged to court if there is anything that can allow this kind of action. So I have to be cautious, and we had to be cautious, very cautious. By the way, we hear that there are attempts now to sue the publisher, so we had to be very cautious about this thing. There was no really trace of Polish government meddling in this. We heard the stories about Chinese government, Russian government, being very, so to say, active in Wikipedia. But in this case, what we found was strange because at the time when we were writing the article, there was a massive leak of emails between Polish prime minister and his advisors. And lo and behold, in one batch, there was a whole discussion of how Polish foreign ministry or foreign affairs should hire people who will position certain websites and intervene on Hebrew Wikipedia in matters dealing with Polish Jewish history. So this thing is the governments have not forgotten Wikipedia, and I am absolutely certain that there is a strong, I mean, what you hear now from various parts of the world makes me very, very skeptical of this objectivity, alleged objectivity of Wikipedia.
Now, speaking of which, you know, one of the reasons that I wanted you to come on the podcast is that post October 7th, we have seen a real rise in these kinds of issues beyond just, you know, what you've been describing. One of the best known examples involves the Anti-Defamation League in the United States, the ADL, which in June was rated by a group of Wikipedia editors and administrators as generally unreliable on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and only roughly reliable on anti-Semitism. And the notion that one of the best known groups focused on this issue is somehow no longer reliable to talk about it. Or if one takes a look at the changes we've seen, let's say, with respect to the article on Zionism, it's undergone massive changes in the last number of months, really highlights what feels like something that is more than just even your well-read space. It's much broader than that. You know, what kind of things have you been hearing and seeing as part of this broader issue with respect to Wikipedia?
Right. I mean, I received a lot of emails. I would say close to 100, perhaps, shortly after the piece has been published, and they trickled later on too. The thing is that the method of undermining the mainstream sources and elevating marginal ones, or keeping honest editors at bay, this pattern of behavior has been reported from a variety of different areas, including, for instance, people trying to get the message across regarding global warming. The same pattern of distortion and denial. Let's say rejection of factual information has been observed, and especially everything now since October 7, and even before, dealing with Jews has been undergoing tremendous pressure, because now you have confluence of two basically currents, from what I understand, attack on ideas like Zionism, for instance, comes from the right and from the left. I would say much more even from the left now than from the right. So the tired argument arguments of the right actually now are being supplanted by so-called anti-colonialist speech. So the same kind of massive offensive but once again, I am not especially qualified. I can observe that these things happen. What you mentioned, I mean, denying B'nai B'rit expertise or undermining the quality of their statements or the it's something I find very appalling. And once it's being done, you can suspect, of course, official involvement, as you could do in the case of encampments. But this is something very difficult to prove. In case of Wikipedia, they have something called, which actually our article was the first article that triggered an action by something called ARBCOM, Arbiters Committee, Arbitration Committee. It is their own Wikipedia senior editors who are usually called to come and to help. If there is a big trouble, then they converge and they have a sort of court, I would say, or star chamber rather. You can observe their sometimes completely ridiculous deliberations online, as it happened in our case. In our case, ARBCOM convened itself. It has not been convened by anyone. It was the first time in the history of Wikipedia that this ARBCOM came together by its own volition, in order to pronounce over the content of our article. And lo and behold, there were people who knew nothing, of course, about the Holocaust, or second thing to nothing, but they were the judges. And the thing is, they could not, because that's one of their rules, they could not pronounce themselves on the content of the case, but on the form. In other words, did the editors keep the decorum? Were they polite one to another? Did they abuse any kind of formal rules here? So if they use cuss words, then the only actually person censored by them in this case was one of the editors who used filthy language addressing other editors. So as far as self-cleansing of Wikipedia, nothing changed. So as far as self-cleansing of Wikipedia is concerned, in the case of, let's say, Jewish affairs of Israel, of Israel-Palestine conflict, I am deeply pessimistic.
I hate to close on such a pessimistic note. You know, it's interesting that that your article gave rise to the review that you talk about. Do you have any other thoughts on potential reforms and solutions? I mean, we know Wikipedia is such an important resource. Well, is there any way, or how do we go about trying to address it so it kind of retains that value?
You know, when I started, you know, hollering in my own scientific academic community, there was actually a lot of anxiety. And Holocaust being a particular area, there was actually a project of getting together a consortium of all possible, museums, educational institutions devoted to study and education about the Holocaust, and to create some kind of alternative source of information, which would, in discussing with the major websites, the browsing machines, position this new encyclopedia of the Holocaust created by consortium of different museums and institutions above Wikipedia. It's technically possible, not that I know much about this, but it is will be very, very costly too. Finally, I don't think it won't fly. And the idea is to work with Wikipedia, which, for instance, some people say, let professors write these reviews or these entries, change it. No, it doesn't make any sense, because your standing and mine is just as good inside the Wikipedia as any other John Doe from the street. So we would be simply shouted down. So my idea is perhaps to force Wikipedia to advertise the level of, let's say, how the articles are inadequate, because usually how good they are. In other words, a warning should flash. This is just, you know, first attempt. This has not been vetted. Perhaps this would alert people that they should look for information further on. I don't know. But it's a growing problem, and really I would have to end also on a pessimistic note.
Okay. Well, you know, certainly it is, you know, having identified the problem is an important step to trying to find ways to fix it, even if those are challenging. Thank you for the work that you've done, both on this and more broadly on Holocaust research. And thank you so much for coming on to talk about these issues on an important episode here on October, dropping on October 7th on this podcast.
Well, thank you very much for this invitation, and I wish you a wonderful, wonderful day.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbytes@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBytesPod or Michael Geist at MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.